From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. Dr. Lynn Fenton is the only psychiatrist in the history of the United States to be publicly revealed as the doctor of a mass shooter. And almost 10 years after the deadly shooting at a Colorado movie theater, Dr. Fenton is telling her story in a new book. It's called Aurora. The psychiatrist who treated the movie theater killer tells her story. We are lucky enough to have Dr. Fenton joining us now. And a warning for our listeners right now, we will be talking about shootings and gun violence during this interview. So be aware as we start this conversation. Dr. Fenton, I want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first off, tell us just a little bit about your background as a psychiatrist and how long you've been practicing.
So psychiatry actually is my second medical specialty. I started off with physical medicine and rehabilitation and practiced that for 15, 20 years, but became really fascinated by the effects of therapy and also how important one's mental health is, even sometimes above and beyond physical health. So I went back and did a second residency at the University of Colorado. And became a psychiatrist, stayed on to practice there. In fact, I still work for the university. And at the time that I saw Holmes, I was the director of student mental health, which was a service to see all of the graduate students that we had on the campus.
So you, as you mentioned, you treated Holmes before the shooting in Aurora. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
Mm-hmm. So he came in of his own accord to get some help with his anxiety. He was very nervous and awkward during his lab presentations, to the point where one of his graduate advisors recommended that he come into student mental health and see if we could help him. So, but when Holmes came in, he sort of added, almost as an aside, I have thoughts of killing people. So that's what, you know, sort of started me on this track of trying to get more details about that. Was this just sort of some idle or obsessive thoughts popping into his head, or was he planning on doing something? So from the get-go, I had a bad gut feeling about this guy, and I could not tell where it was coming from, because although he was extremely awkward, even kind of moved a little robotically and didn't talk much, he had no past history of violence. You know, he was never mean to animals. He had friends, he had girlfriends, and so there weren't any of these big red flags that indicated that he potentially could do something serious.
So, you know, talk a little bit more about that then. I mean, here he comes in and he makes this one statement that sends, kind of alarm bells in your head. But other than that, and I don't want to take that lightly at all, but I mean, you've treated many people over the years. What was your thought process? I mean, what did you go through? I mean, looking at his psyche, looking at who he was as a patient, beyond that one statement.
Mm-hmm. So at first, knowing that he was a very anxious person, I thought these were just sort of anxious, obsessive thoughts that he didn't like thinking about, he didn't want to think about. And this type of thing's pretty common in folks, especially if they're under stress. But it turned out one of the days he said, oh, I don't mind thinking about these thoughts. And then, you know, I just had this pit in the bottom of my stomach and was spending a lot of time trying to figure out if he was angry, perhaps at a person or a group of people. Was there somebody he'd like to get back at? Was he bullied? And, you know, I'm just coming up blank in all these directions. That being said, it was very hard to get him to say more than a couple words. So They were difficult conversations, but from what I could gather, he, you know, didn't have any beefs against anybody. And he never would say that he actually was planning something, or if he was going to hurt someone, what he would do. He denied he had any guns or other weapons, which the last month I was treating him was just a lie, because it turns out in retrospect, we know he was amassing an arsenal and going to the shooting range and shooting up human figures too. So all along, I had this bad feeling about him. I couldn't get much information. He never gave me enough to put him on what's called a mental health hold, where you can so-called lock somebody up against their will for up to 72 hours if they are a danger to others. But that would have taken more than just this vague statement, I have thoughts of killing people. He would have had to actually had maybe a target, a place, a person, a group of people, or something imminent, like next week I'm going to do this, not just someday I'm going to hurt some people. And that being said, even if we put him on a mental health hold, people who are smart and determined, like Holmes was, can just lie during the 72 hours. We don't have a truth serum or a crystal ball to know really what's in their head. So even if we had put him on a mental health hold, I'm not sure that that would have prevented this.
I want to talk a little bit about the unmasking of your identity, because this is unprecedented when this happened. You know, what it did to you. I mean, from a personal standpoint, I mean, I think the vilification, there was an investigation by your university. Then there was a judge's gag order. So you could not talk. So I'd like to hear about that. And then from there, let's talk a little bit about how, as you mentioned, there wasn't, I mean, you couldn't just go to the police and say this person may do this, because as you mentioned, you didn't have anything besides a statement, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Right. And maybe I'll talk about that last part first. We did not have a red flag law at the time in Colorado, so that it's possible that might have helped. But I did go to our whole threat assessment team. So a little context, at the very last time I saw Holmes, which was about five weeks before the shooting, he was dropping out of school because he failed this exam. And so I offered to keep seeing him for free, even though he was going to lose his insurance. He didn't agree to that. And he also did not agree for me to talk to anyone, friends or family, who could give me a little more context. But after he left my office, I still was so worried about him that I just sort of broke that rule. I called his mom anyway, spoke to her for a bit, and it sounded like he'd always been, you know, kind of awkward, nerdy, nervous, that this wasn't a big change. So that reassured me a little bit that this was not like a new psychotic break. And then I did call all the members of our threat assessment team at the university, including the campus police officer who could check and see if he had a criminal record. At the time, I thought it could check and see if he had any guns, but Colorado's a state where you don't need to register or get a license to be able to buy weapons. And so, in fact, he had already by that time bought an arsenal, online and in person, and been going to the shooting range. But you know, none of that came up because you can't search for that. So then back to the question about what happened with my unmasking. So my name was in a court document that was posted online just a week after the shooting. And normally my name would have been redacted, but somebody forgot to do that, I guess. And so that's how the press and the public got my name. And, you know, even though I knew it was logical for everyone to search for a reason. Why did this happen? Did somebody drop the ball? What can we do next time? And I knew that I was kind of a logical scapegoat. What? A psychiatrist saw him beforehand? Well, she should have seen this coming, or she should have just locked him up. I knew that intellectually, but it was really hard not to take it personally when I had, you know, all these dozens of emails and physical mail and voicemail saying, you know, this blood is on your hands, you're going to pay for this, you know, that kind of stuff. It was really difficult, and it ended in me resigning from my medical directorship of the Student Mental Health Service, even though the Department of Psychiatry did not want me to step down from that, but it just had become too complex, too distracting, and I felt like I couldn't provide the best care for the rest of the students. So I continued to work at the university. I still work there now, but have just was in different clinics, basically.
Can we talk about, here we are 10 years later, mass shootings have not stopped. Some can argue we have seen even more of them in this last decade. There is so much talk about mental health issues and this this idea that this is happening because there are a lack of mental health services or people are mentally ill. And I would like your thoughts on that, because you say you're confident that improved mental health care, that alone cannot stop what we're seeing in this country.
I am sure of that. I think we do need more access to mental health care, and that would help for the other type of gun violence, which is suicide. But I don't think it's going to make any dent in these mass shootings for a number of reasons. One is that only about a quarter of these mass shooters have a mental health diagnosis. So the rest of them are just, they're angry, they're aggrieved, they got fired, they're externalizing. They blame all their personal problems on the rest of the world, and they, you know, want to even the score. And those externalizing people are about the last people who would come in for counseling or psychiatric treatment of any type. So even those who do have a diagnosis would rarely come in. Of course, Holmes is in that category of the rare folks who do come in, but he didn't come in for treatment of these thoughts of killing people. He came in because he was anxious.
So with that said, mental health services alone, in your view, will not help. You mentioned that 10 years ago, Colorado did not have red flag laws. Talk about your views about the importance of red flag laws. Could you have done something different if that had been in effect 10 years ago?
Yeah, potentially. I could have reported him under the red flag law. By that last visit that I saw him, if law enforcement had gone to his apartment, they probably would have found, you know, this arsenal of weapons that he was amassing. So I think a red flag law possibly could have made a difference. And in lots of cases, I think it really can be helpful. It gives one more avenue for everyone. So the public, you know, friends, family, if they're worried about somebody for suicide or homicide, they can report them to law enforcement, which can allow then the police to confiscate weapons that they have at the time and potentially for a time keep them from buying new weapons. And it's this restricting access to lethal means that I think is potentially will have the biggest impact on preventing these mass shootings.
Before I let you go, as you look back, you know, 10 years from this mass shooting. What is your biggest takeaway? What should we as a society take from you and your experience and you know, not only treating this person before the shooting, but then seeing him even after this massacre?
Well, so just to clarify, so I did not treat him afterwards. The
right.
only time I saw
exactly.
him afterwards was in court when he was sitting there and I was mm-hmm. testifying. But you're right, we have a massive amount of data in this case, which is one of the reasons I went ahead and wrote the book, because we can look at him before, during, and after, and try to think, you know, what could we do differently? And with this case, I feel strongly that more mental health would not prevent these. He had plenty of mental health, easy access. It made no difference. Also, some folks have asked about like the childhood of shooters. This guy would defy that as well, because he had a very normal upbringing, you know, two great parents with good jobs, a little sister, you know, no serious problems there. Mm-hmm. And really, when you sort of look at each of these things that maybe would help, like the red flag law, I think potentially could have helped. Really, it just all filters down to limiting these lethal means to potential shooters, especially young shooters. So Holmes was 24, and about a quarter of shooters of these mass shootings are under the age 25. And this makes sense when we know our brains don't finish developing until our late 20s. So before that, especially late teens, early 20s, there's a big mismatch between aggression, impulsivity, and the lack of ability to control ourselves. So I take away, not only do we need gun safety and limiting lethal means to all folks, but particularly this young adult age group. Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you so much for the conversation today. I know that it is a difficult thing to talk about, but you know, important that we have these conversations. So I want to thank you for your time, Dr. Fenton.
You're so welcome, and it was good talking to you, even though it's a tough subject.
It is, and it is important to note that there were 12 people who were killed in that movie theater shooting on July 20th of 2012. So we want to acknowledge that as we talk about this as well. We have been talking with Dr. Lynn Fenton. Her book, Aurora, The Psychiatrist Who Treated the Movie Theater Killer Tells Her Story, is available now.